coordinated. I love that. Today on
Sex and the Bull City.
Yeah, we are recording a podcast and you might not even know us. We are at Bull City Psychotherapy. I am Celinda Malone and this is my fifth day as an associate at the practice.
Nice.
I was an intern here before that, and I am newly licensed and taking the clients. And this is Marcus. Tell us about you, Marcus.
Hello, I'm Marcus Walton. I am in my last year of a Master's of Clinical Mental Health Counseling at North Carolina Central. Go Eagles. I'm an intern here at Bull City Psychotherapy. I've been here since the fall, and I'm also taking new clients, and I'm doing sliding scale, $10 to $30 a session, or even pro bono, considering taking those on too. So I kind of have interests in grief and crisis, also trauma, PTSD, those kinds of things, EMDR therapy.
We're both EMDR trained.
Yeah. And mood disorders, life transitions, ADHD, neurodivergent populations, people that are LGBTQIA+ identified, so, and so much more. But that's a little taste of where I'm at.
And you can bring me all things sex and gender. That's kind of my interest. And I am a CSAT candidate, EMDR trained, do some schema work. Mm-hmm. And today we are going to talk about a shared interest in religious trauma and purity culture. And tell me a little bit about your background in the religious world. And I'll tell you a little about mine.
Yeah. So very deeply steeped in the Christian tradition. Particularly, I grew up going to a Southern Baptist church with evangelical fundamentalist world, which is kind of the ferment out of which purity culture grew. And my mom was a church secretary, and so I was at church all the time. Anytime the doors were open, I was there. And, you know, collected my own share of religiously traumatic experiences, and was very steeped in purity culture. I was in youth group kind of in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so I was right there for the unfolding of a lot of what we're going to be talking about. And I'm still, it's been a journey. I'm like a reluctantly religious person. I can't seem to get away from it. I've tried.
Fair enough.
But I have a spiritual practice, and it's very much still informed by the Christian tradition, but a lot more by the Buddhist tradition over the past year. I would say my meditation practice is in many ways core, as well as my yoga practice. And still always figuring that out. It changes as I change and grow.
So, as well it should.
Yeah. And yourself?
So I was raised fundamentalist, evangelical as well. I went to Bible college and finished a minor in Bible and theology. I used to work as the youth director at a church. My dad was the head elder, still is. I have a whole history there too, around purity culture and its lasting impacts on our lives. So we're using that term like everybody knows what it means. Let's talk a little about what purity culture is so that our listeners can have a sense of what we're talking about. If you're from an evangelical background of a certain time frame, you probably already know about purity culture. But a little bit about it. Tell us what it sounded like for you. What is purity culture for you?
Well, I mean, probably at its most clearly articulated and recognized for me, it was the youth group that I was in undertook the sort of True Love Waits program. So, which was like, True Love Waits was a book, right? First, that was written by, or wait, was the book I Kissed Dating Goodbye by Joshua Harris? Are those different? True Love Waits? Okay. So True Love Waits was a program that essentially strongly encouraged.
Expected.
Yeah. Teens to remain abstinent until marriage. And with a pretty broad definition of abstinence, which sort of gets to the purity bit. So I had a promised, like, True Love Waits ring that was given out to me and my peers. Mm-hmm. And so I wore this ring that looked like a wedding ring that indicated my sort of promising the purity of my body to God and my future spouse. Mm-hmm. And I was made to be, I think, very uncomfortable with and afraid of my own sexuality as a dangerous force that kind of had to be kept in check.
Under wrap.
Yeah, very much. But I bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. I was all in.
Same. I think back, and I came up in the early 90s. Yeah. And there were really three pillars of kind of purity culture for me. One was abstinence that you're talking about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was also the very high expectation of modesty.
Mm-hmm.
And not making people stumble by the clothing that you would wear or provocative behavior. And kind of married to that were very strict gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
Very specific expectations around female gatekeeping of sexuality and male inability to control themselves was kind of the expectation that this was the experience that people were going to be having.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it looked like in my world.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember in Bible college, there was this, we had to go to chapel every day. 5 days a week, you're in chapel. And there was a particular chapel where the campus pastor expected us to sign a purity pledge. Yeah. And he called everybody down to the front, and he said, you know, I'm going to keep this on file. And if you get asked out by somebody, you can come to me and say, can I see their purity pledge?
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to, you know, do this checking up and holding one another accountable for behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt really manipulative to me at the time, even when I was in the thick of my belief and, you know, buying into this idea of purity.
Oh, interesting.
It still felt really manipulative to me.
Really?
Huh. And yeah. I was one of, like, six people in the audience who didn't go forward. And he came to me about it afterward and wanted to know, you know, why, what's going on there. But the thing that I found really difficult was that I knew most of those people who were signing this pledge, and I knew what they were doing on Saturday nights. And I knew that they knew the places that you could drive your car and park and have sex. And I was well aware that the things they were saying they were doing were performative.
Yes.
And there is an aspect to that of purity culture. Even for those of us who bought into it, there's a certain degree to which you're performing.
One thing I didn't mention about myself, but is kind of relevant here in a story that I'm seeing we both share in different ways, which is, I didn't mention that I went to divinity school at Duke, which is, I think divinity school is a place that a lot of people go who are true believers and who like are desperately trying to hold on to their faith in the face of all sorts of forces of critical thinking and deconstruction, right? Okay. And I think you and I shared that kind of, for me, I went to div school. It looked, you know, different from you, but we were both true believers, you know, who even if you didn't get up and sign the card, you were walking the walk.
I was.
In the language of evangelical culture. And similar to me, I think I mentioned Celine recently, we were talking about some of these things, and that I came to find out years later where I thought I was surrounded by true believers. I didn't know what you knew then about Saturday night. And I found out, like, everyone was getting laid except me. The hypocrisy was not on my radar. It was not on my radar. Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned True Love Waits. There's another book that came out, I think 1997, Joshua Harris, called I Kissed Dating Goodbye. Mm-hmm. And it went to the extreme. It built on the work of Elizabeth Elliot. She was a missionary wife. Her husband died in a first encounter with a people who had not been contacted by outsiders before. And she became somewhat of a celebrity in the 70s. Hmm. And
I remember that story. I didn't know it was
something. She did a lot of writing around purity.
Yeah.
And then she did a lot of promotion for his book.
Mm.
And it was kind of the modern day version of, was it Purity and Passion, maybe was her name, the name of her book? I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But this True Love Waits book really took it to the extreme, that the expectation was not just that you waited to have sex. You didn't kiss somebody. You didn't ask anybody out.
Mm-hmm.
There was an arrangement that was made that your parents or your church leaders would notice that there are these young people and let's pair them up. Let's get them together. And then if that works out, then, you know, they meet a couple of times, and if that works out, you can get married, and then on your wedding day, you can kiss your bride.
Yeah, I'm realizing as you're describing this, you know, Celinda and I did some training with the Religious Trauma Institute, and a lot of what you're describing right here seems, you know, just spot on descriptive of high control religion, right?
Oh, 100%.
You know, exerting great control over what many would think of as the most private and personal details of their life and exercise of their agency. So deep reaching in, you know, into people's private lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can remember a sense of my body not belonging to me. I was literally told, your body does not belong to you. It belongs to Christ and your future husband.
Yes, that's right.
And I learned to dissociate from my body pretty young. I was told that emotions were sinful. I was told that any kind of sexual interest was sinful.
Mm-hmm.
Everything qualifies as lust, and lust is always bad.
Yeah.
To this day, that's a thing that I work on in therapy, is being in my body and paying attention to what's going on there. I think another thing that we haven't really touched on, but the kind of the history of purity culture and what it is the effects that it had on education around sex. What kind of education did you have around sex when you were in public school? Were you a public school kid?
Yeah, I was in public school in Nashville, Tennessee. And I mean, I literally had zero sex education. I think there was one context in which it was delivered, and and obviously not very highly prioritized. There was a class called Teen Living, it was kind of an elective style class in eighth grade, and because I was the kind of nerd who was both in band and German, I had my elective slots were stacked, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't take Teen Living. And so I never saw the condom go on the banana. I never got any of it, mm-hmm. you know? And then, you know, in my home life, you know, I think, and this is kind of informed by purity culture, right? Mm-hmm. I think instead of parents who were frank and honest and direct about a positive framing of puberty or sexuality or anything like that, there was silence, you know? Mm-hmm. And my parents, I think, were terrified of talking about those things. Even though if you would have asked them, pressed them, I bet they would have said they were uncomfortable with me learning that at school, too. Mm-hmm. Which is often this message that you hear. It's mm-hmm. kind of like you're not really, parents are not giving good sex education at home, mm-hmm. really. And then, but the, also, it's like, don't you dare sort of violate the sanctity of this subject with my child, mm-hmm. who I want to raise in my values and not these, not mm-hmm. this secular kind of public education framework. So
I remember we were watching the movie Private Benjamin, old Goldie Hawn movie. And it's a movie about Goldie mm-hmm. Hawn getting married very young. And mm-hmm. then on her wedding night, her husband dies and she is left prospectless and has to join the military. That's the plot of the movie. And
very strange.
There's a sex scene, and I remember this being on. I would have been 9th, 10th grade, and it was one of the first times I was exposed to sexual content.
Mm. Yeah.
And my dad's policy, apparently, he never said this out loud because that was part of the policy, mm-hmm. was to just silently watch whatever is happening and don't acknowledge that some sexual content is happening. And I remember my mother walking into the room as she would do when we were watching a movie and saying, "Bob, what are you letting her watch?"
Mm.
And that was all that was said. There was no follow-up. There was no education. Mm-hmm. The only thing there was what was said at church. Mm-hmm. And what was said at church was don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know anything else.
Yeah.
Just don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the effects of that, if we can move into the effects,
yeah.
has been that there's kind of this dichotomy of you are to remain naive and pure mm-hmm. and fairy tale romance
mm-hmm.
up until you are mm-hmm. married.
Yeah.
And then the night that you are married, you are told will be the best night of your life. Mm-hmm. And you will go from being this naive, knowing nothing about sex, to a masterful sex machine. That you know how to do with everything, and you know how to give and receive pleasure, and you mm-hmm. know how to be in your body, and you, mm-hmm. you know, this lead up to this event is really hyped up in that culture.
It strikes me there's this kind of chosen and deliberate ignorance of just a basic developmental reality. Because mm-hmm. what I heard you describing was this sort of desperate, like, we must keep our children pure yes. until they are magically transformed into adults by having sex, you know? And so many cultures, you know, recognize that adolescence is this profound transition that's mm-hmm. that's structured by rituals, and like it's protected and it's supported. And like you're saying, there's this kind of like child, 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 adult, you know, like
mm-hmm.
just push you off
into here's adulthood. The ritual, and if going down the aisle doesn't, you know, fix, make you magically mature, mm-hmm. we don't know what will.
Yeah.
You know, you said something about it being protective, and I do want us to talk a little bit about the protective nature of purity culture and mm-hmm. what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, the phrase you used earlier with me today was give credit where credit is due, that they are trying to take mm-hmm. something that can be very powerful and very, mm-hmm. Life-changing, maybe is a good way to say that.
Yeah, sure.
It can take that and protect you from the the worst of that, from the biggest dangers of that. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're attempting to do by controlling our bodies, by controlling our minds. Mm-hmm. And I respect that they acknowledge sex as being powerful.
Yeah, that's right. Powerful, weighty, sometimes with consequences that are not fully accounted for by young and developing minds.
Mm.
You know, you hear the line, abstinence is the only 100% sure form of birth control, which on the surface is true. It's just that there are other stories than that. And, you know, yeah. Another thing we thought of earlier is just that element of, you know, purity culture is a culture that is, that was cultivated in church contexts, church communities. But it's also codified into law that, like, you know, I took a sexuality class at Central, and one of our assignments was to look into, to go back to the sex education piece, to look into what the legal requirements for sex education are as decided by the states, decided state by state for the education system in that state. And what I read in both North Carolina, where I currently reside, and in Tennessee, where I grew up, were both, they both seem to have been written by, it felt like, I was joking to her, it felt like they were written by youth pastors, you know, from evangelical churches, because their emphasis on abstinence was, I mean, it was absolute, and it made very little room for frank discussion of anything, you know, coming from, you know, I would say, broadly speaking, a sex positive, you know, frame. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So their intent was to protect. What were the actual effects? What were the effects in your life?
Well, I mean, you know, maybe another generational marker, you know, and I'm comfortable saying this, you know, I said my parents didn't teach me, and then I didn't get the class in school or whatever, but like many people my age, my exposure to sexuality then was through pornography.
Correct.
You know? And that's sex education for a lot of kids today, and even beginning in my age. I'm an elder millennial, you know, born in 1984, and the advent of the internet, you know, was my adolescence. And, you know, so there was that. I had the curiosity, you know, desire. I had all these natural things that we have around our sexuality, and there was no outlet for it, you know? There was no outlet in my church community. There was no outlet at school. There was no outlet at home. And so, you know, it was discussions among, you know, ignorant children who didn't know any better and had a lot of weird mixed up ideas. And then it was exposure, you know, to pornography. And so I would say in one effect then is to say that there was no one taking any real responsibility for for the formation of my sexual imagination, right? Which, even if I'm being told this is what you need to know about sex, and it's shaped by fear, and it's shaped by what, essentially negatively, what not to do. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, my own curiosity and desire, an innate sense that sexuality is something vital and life-giving in me, it found outlets. You know what I mean? And that's the thing. There, something will out, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think just the giving up of that responsibility.
Passing that they the buck. Did.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. What about for you?
I would say probably two really big impacts. One, I think, is a broader problem around the same idea with relationships. Mm-hmm. That you're supposed to go from not knowing how to have a romantic relationship because you mm-hmm. really don't, to being a master of romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. And that had a lot of impact on me and being able to make choices about partners. And I'm divorced and remarried, and I've learned my lessons the hard way around mm-hmm. forming of relationships. Mm-hmm. And even though that's not specific to sex, it comes from the same place as naivety around relationships and naivety around sex.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The other place that I would say that sexuality was impacted for me, strict gender roles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very specific expectations around the role that women are to play in a patriarchal system. Mm-hmm. Specifically around sexuality. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think the idea that we are somehow responsible for another person's thoughts. Mm-hmm. That we are somehow responsible for their experience of their sexuality mm-hmm. is dangerous. When you it takes the responsibility off the individual mm-hmm. and puts it onto somebody that actually has no control over it.
That's right.
And it results in a really helpless feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm recalling lingo around this, like guarding hearts. Did you ever hear that?
It's just for
like,
sure.
So the a woman is responsible for guarding the hearts of men. So mm-hmm. it's like, again, the sort of subtext being men cannot help their voracious and bestial sexual desires, you know, that are just coursing mm-hmm. through them. And also like kind of being implied that women don't really want sex either. It's just also like true. Something that you kind of, you know, begrudgingly assent to from these disgusting
right.
men.
and
so you, it's you have to guard their hearts.
That's right. You don't cause a brother to stumble.
Right.
Yes. That's the phrase that comes to my mind. Mm-hmm. And that responsibility for men's sexuality mm-hmm. really more broadly for their emotional experience. I see that as a clinician, that comes in the door sometimes, that somebody else is responsible for somebody's emotional experience, somebody's mm-hmm. sexual experience, somebody's
mm-hmm. yeah.
Experience. And
I see it a lot too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see, I currently am seeing a lot of women who are coming in and talking about their difficult relationships and how all kinds of emotional labor has been outsourced to them, so mm. to speak. That they are having to do emotional labor for the men who don't know what to do with their feelings, who don't even mm-hmm. have circumspection about the fact that they have feelings. Yeah.
You know, I think that's part of the strict gender role. You know, I can talk about the female experience there, mm-hmm. but I very much recognize that it puts just as much toxic expectation mm-hmm. on men around sex.
Yeah, absolutely.
That men are you know, I was saying earlier, you're supposed to go from, you know, 0 to 60 in, you know, no time flat, that you mm-hmm. know nothing and then you're a master.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's right. this expectation right. that if you're truly manly, then you, or masculine, then you will know how to please a woman. You will know how to mm-hmm. be sexual.
It's strangely enough, it seems to turn on a somewhat unspoken assumption that, and this is interesting to talk about it as a result of a theological framework, but it almost plays on an assumed naturalness of sex. Mm-hmm. You know, that like, it's just right. natural. It just comes easily, and that our bodies know how to do it. You know, you don't mm-hmm. have to train yourself to get an erection, so you're off to the races, right? You
right.
know? And it's like, yeah, sex is natural, but it's a lot more complicated, though.
It is. And there's a lot more about interaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, can a 2-year-old that doesn't know how to talk, or, you know, that has never had any exposure to sex, figure out how to touch their penis? Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But do they know, when do we learn how to interactively mm-hmm. be with the physicality of another person?
Mm-hmm. And desire and arousal and attraction and all that is, it's not just natural. It's social. It's always socially conditioned, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a skill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I liked the analogy that you used earlier today, that just because you listen to jazz for 20 years doesn't mm-hmm. mean you can pick up a clarinet and play it.
That's right.
Right?
You gotta practice.
You can consume mm-hmm. media about sex and pornography. Mm-hmm. You can read about it. But until you are mm-hmm. in a situation with mm-hmm. a partner or partners... Mm-hmm. there's really no way to know how that's going to go.
Yeah.
And being masterful is more about communication and mm-hmm. the social piece
yeah.
than it is about physicality.
Right. And when you talk about masterfulness, it's like, I think with intimacy and vulnerability, you know, one like wonderful gift is like to have the permission to fail spectacularly, mm-hmm. which is to say to be a beginner and to be a learner mm-hmm. and to not know what you're doing, mm-hmm. you know? And like you said, and it people are stripped of that when you're expected to show up and, like you said, be a master, be an instant adult, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking a lot about, the effects. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about, what do you do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody comes in your office and they say, you know, I had no idea what sex really was mm-hmm. until I was, you know, had been married for a while. I have these negative effects, you know, I'm having sexual dysfunctions. I'm afraid of sex because it's always been mm-hmm. portrayed as negative. It's always been portrayed as sinful and yeah. of the body. What do you do about that?
Oof. I don't know. I mean, you know, one thing you mentioned earlier that we haven't talked a whole lot about is the way that purity culture also, as it puts up all these danger flags, right, and roots mm-hmm. us in so much fear, it alienates us from our body.
Mm-hmm.
And the body is not just instrumentalized, but kind of like weaponized. It's like this mm-hmm. thing. It's this thing of great danger that we have to be very, very careful with. And even though, again, we talked about consequences, it's like, okay, you know, pregnancy, STIs, right? These are all real risks. Nevertheless, that's not those are possibilities. That's not the heart of what sexuality is. And that's not the heart of the meaning of our bodies. And so I think it's maybe starting with the self, you know, what is your relationship to your body, and
healing that connection first.
Yeah. So the body, not as this instrumentalized thing, not a thing that performs, but maybe the body is home, you know, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's my instinct of where to start.
That's a place that you would want to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think one of the places that is easier today than it has ever been to not fight back, but to respond, to resist this, these negative effects of purity culture, was around education. You know, we talked about the abstinence-only education. We talked about the passing of the buck. There are books and websites and columnists and advice givers and therapists and people all over the place today that know more about sex than we've ever known.
Yeah, that's true.
And just some examples. I love Emily Nagoski's Come As You Are. It's a fabulous book. It looks like it's written just for women because it's pink and it has a vulva on the cover. But
nice.
It's really for everyone. And the basic understanding of the fundamentals of sex. And if you want to be a good partner, you know, knowing that and understanding that is useful. There's also a group that I just found yesterday called Sex Evangelicals.
Oh.
For like evangelical or ex-evangelical, which is kind of its own mash of up of a word.
Yeah,
adding sex to that their job is to give the sex education you always wish you'd had. So if this is you and you have experienced any aspect of this, start with education. Start with curiosity, and don't assume that porn has actually taught you what you think it's taught you. It's entertainment. I used to use the illustration of wild car chases in movies, right? Like, you can watch Mel Gibson drive a car through a building and out the other side, and it's entertaining, but it doesn't mean you try it on the way home. Right? Like, I'm dating myself with a Mel Gibson reference. But the idea that it's entertainment and it's not necessarily all that real. But educate yourself. Be intentional around sex. Journaling, give it thought, talk about your partner to your partner or partners. And don't treat it like it's this mystery that you have to solve all by yourself.
I was trying to think of some resources that I might recommend. I haven't read as much on this as I think you have, but something I've been curious about is reading Hold Me Tight by Sue Johnson, which is Sue Johnson is kind of the founder of emotionally focused therapy. And so she's all about working from attachment theory. And I do think sexuality and attachment are really, really bound up together. And I think that would be a good resource. And then I've always got to give a plug for Internal Family Systems. And Richard Schwartz, I can't remember who he co-authored it with, but he wrote a book called You Are the One You've Been Waiting For. And it's IFS as it informs couples work. But as we were kind of saying with that, the body is home kind of. I think, and you said like the self is home. That's very much the internal family systems, you know, where it would start with that. So,
I think this was a good conversation today.
Yeah.
And I'd like to have some more conversations, maybe around some of the details that we just touched on today.
Yeah.
Around purity culture.
This is just the tip of the purity berg. The virgin berg.
Fair enough. I think this is a good start to a conversation around purity culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be curious to hear from listeners what their experiences have been. If you are somebody who has experienced this and are now experiencing difficulties with your sexuality, we are accepting new clients, and we're able to practice anywhere in the state of North Carolina. All right. Any final thoughts today?
I don't think so. Thank you, Celine. This is really great. I'm looking forward to keeping this conversation going.
Same.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Great job.